something. Get you some facts right here. Get you some facts.
Welcome to Song Facts Podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie R. Myers. Our guest today is Jose James. Jose James is a groundbreaking vocalist known for seamlessly blending jazz, soul, hip-hop, and R&B into a distinctive and captivating musical style all his own. Born in Minneapolis, Jose was exposed to a wide range of musical influences from an early age, including the sounds of jazz legends like John Coltrane and Miles Davis, as well as the soulful grooves of Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder. These influences would later shape his innovative approach to his own music. Jose rose to prominence in the mid-2000s with the release of his debut album, The Dreamer, which garnered widespread acclaim for its fusion of jazz improvisation with soulful melodies and hip-hop-inspired rhythms. Throughout his career, Jose has continued to push the boundaries of genre and style, collaborating with a diverse array of artists and exploring new sonic landscapes. His latest album, 1978, has further solidified his reputation as a dynamic and versatile artist. Jose continues to push the boundaries of contemporary jazz and soul, cementing his legacy as one of the most exciting voices in modern music. We spoke with Jose about his creative process, his new music, and what's next. You've been called a jazz singer for the hip-hop generation. Can you tell our listeners more about that and what that means to you?
That was actually something brilliant and catchy that I came up with on my first album. I quickly learned that if you don't sort of like shape the conversation around yourself as an artist, other people will do it for you. I don't know where that came from, but it just kind of made sense. And I think it's something I grew into over the years. You know, me and Robert Glasper, Christian Scott, Atunde, Ajua, our generation, I think, is the first generation to grow up listening to jazz through the lens of hip hop, you know, in Rakim samples, Prince Paul samples, Alicia Heath Muhammad, Q-Tip, all of these jazz, you know, the hip hop producers were sampling jazz and soul records. So the first time I heard jazz, it was, you know, through Cypress Hill or Digable Planets or something like that. So I've always sort of looked at jazz as this mutable, expandable, and very current thing. Even if you're going back to like Louis Armstrong or whatever, I'm always trying to find a way to make it feel like today.
What inspired your new single, Dark Side of the Sun?
It's a good question. You know, first, I think it's the sound. I've been producing a lot of tracks at home with Ableton, making beats and, you know, kind of trying to like connect my songwriting side to my contemporary production side.
On the street with no name, and now I know the price of fame, babe. Robin told us, but it's all the same. Chris fell to his knees in pain. We all go where we wanna be, flying high on the masterpiece. Rise all your souls of the drum and bass. Ride home on the road of eternal flame. I don't know what the future be. I spit light through the darkest sea. I only know this the only way. Why do we dream of a brighter?
So I downloaded a bunch of J Dilla's, you know, drum sample pack and just started making all these beats. And, you know, I'm kind of fascinated by North African sounds and hand claps and using that. And I did a collaboration in 2013 with Hindi Zara, who's a French Moroccan singer, and we did a song called Sword and Gun. So it's kind of like an updated version of that. Lyrically, it's about this idea of the sun being all life-giving, you know, all light-giving in our universe. But if you get too close to it, obviously it pulls you in and it consumes everything. And for me, Black people historically, in Western society, have always been giving, you know, to society without getting this, reaping the benefits. So it's this idea of living in the dark side of the sun. And, you know, once I sort of like found that idea, that poetic idea, it sort of opened up a lot of concepts for me. Like, I'm a Gen Xer, so like fame is always something that we look at as a little bit like, you know, we're skeptical of it, you know. And, you know, just the challenge of living as a creative person in this digital moment, this digital global society where we're more connected and we're also more disconnected at the same time.
Could you share some insights into your general creative process, particularly when it comes to songwriting?
Typically, I get an idea on my iPhone and I just make a little voice memo. So often I get an idea and I'll beatbox and sing the bass line at the same time. And I get a lot of little quick ideas that are little cells that later I take to the piano or to the guitar and turn into a song. And then once it's a song, I'll kind of go back to Ableton, sit down with some analog synths and maybe my push, which is a beat making instrument, and kind of create a whole demo. And then I give that to the band in the studio. So there are about five different stages at this point of getting to the final version of the song. So I really have to love it, you know, to get to that point. And I still love analog recording. I still love having to pay a lot of money to go into a really nice room to capture something, because it kind of puts a pressure on me as a performer. And I really have to believe in the song as a songwriter as well.
Yeah, that makes me think too, your music often blends these different genres really seamlessly. How do you approach incorporating different styles into your sound?
I do a lot of listening. You know, I listen to a lot of old and new music at the same time. I'm always trying to find something that I like. You know, a good friend of mine kind of helped me get into this concept of just like listening to something you like in everything, in every style of music, whether it's just the snare sound or the vocal production, even if it's a genre that maybe is not my favorite. I'm always trying to like find a way into music. And that's been incredibly helpful. You know, sometimes I'll pull a snare sound from a James Taylor record that I really love, you know, or, you know, a Jay Dilla beat, or, you know, a certain style from Joni Mitchell, or, you know, it really comes from anywhere. And I think that, you know, all of the artists that I admire, you know, all those people, Miles Davis or what have you, they really listen to a lot of different sources and try to get that together. You know, I'm really kind of a writer at heart. You know, literature was my first love. And I think writers are always looking at the world and at society and pulling from different sources. And you don't know why until you need it. You know, you need that reference and you need that, because I don't really believe in, I don't believe in genre. I don't believe in time. I think that everything is sort of happening at the same time, you know, on some cosmic level, you know, so it's all just an expression of the human heart. And if you can find the best way to do that, that's the key.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
You're listening to Song Facts Podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie R. Myers. We're talking with Jose James. You know, it's so interesting as I'm hearing you talk about these artists from James Taylor to Miles Davis, just span across the genres. Were there any particular artists or even musical movements that have had significant influence on your work over just different parts of your career? Have you found yourself going to different artists depending on kind of the time you were in your life?
I've had huge touchstone moments. You know, I mean, I grew up in the golden age of hip hop. So, you know, people like A Tribe Called Quest, Digable Planets, they were huge. De La Soul, huge influences. And, you know, that sort of moment of rap was so diverse. You know, they were pulling from all kinds of sources for the beats, and also what they were talking about was very abstract. You know, the storytelling was at a very high level. When I got into jazz, I think it was really dominated by Billie Holiday and John Coltrane and Miles Davis. They all had a very unique voice, and they were very sort of sure about creating a sound world. You know, when I think of any of those artists, it's not just their music and their instrument, but it's this, the whole vibe. You know, you put on Kind of Blue, you put on The Love Supreme, you put on anything by Billie Holiday, and it just brings you right into this emotional space. And that was very interesting to me. And then outside of that, you know, Marvin Gaye is sort of my go-to for everything else. You know, he really combines this incredible male vulnerability that I find fascinating and lacking in a lot of R&B today. And he also encompasses doo-wop, rhythm and blues, jazz, and R&B in his whole, and funk. So it's really, he's like the master to me.
How have you been able to navigate the balance between staying true to your artistic vision and adapting to the changing music industry?
That is a great question. I think the answer is starting my own record label. You know, that's been the best way to keep creative control and also be nimble. You know, when I was with Blue Note and, you know, EMI and then Universal, it was great to have sort of like the major label support, but I realized that sometimes it's better to be on a speedboat than an ocean liner, you know. Changes happen so quickly now, you know. It's I think it's important for the business side or the label side to align with the vision of the artist. You know, I go through periods where, like right now, I'm highly creative and I want to release a lot of music really quickly, you know, put out a lot of singles, put out an album, keep going. And you know, there is a frustration sometimes when you're on someone else's schedule and they're like, well, we just can't release it. You have to wait 2 years, you know. So it's been incredible to be under the vision of Talia Billick, who's the president of Rainbow Blonde and my creative partner. She just completely gets me as an artist. And, you know, when I say I want to do this project, I want to do a tribute to Erykah Badu this year, she's like, great, let's do it. You know, there's never any barrier to just getting it out worldwide and at the highest level artistically possible, which is very rare. And I'm very lucky. Prince was a huge influence, and I should shout him out because I'm from Minneapolis, and he always talked about artists, songwriters, owning your songs, owning your publishing, owning your masters. And I think it's taken a long time, but I think musicians are finally now understanding what he meant and finally saying, I'm going to take steps to control my work forever, which is cool.
And to really keep an eye on the business side of things, right?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, for so long, we've been sort of taught that, you know, you write the songs, you just go on tour, you look cool, you put on your glasses and your leather jacket, and you drink the champagne, and you go around the world, and we'll handle the rest, you know. And then you see a lot of people in their twilight years, you know, with no control over their masters or their publishing or their image, and broke, you know. And I think it's this idea of is fame worth that, or is it better to put your nose to the grindstone and you know, talk to your accountant, you know, a couple times a week to see what's really going on. You know, it's not as glamorous, but I think it's more important.
So turning to your live performances, you know, they've been really known for their intimacy, authenticity. How do you go about establishing such a strong connection with your audience?
It's a great question, and nobody's ever asked me that before. I think I really, after the pandemic, particularly, I did a lot of soul searching about why I perform, why I create. And I realized that from that point on, I mean, I've done it before, but I really wanted to double down on this idea of we're not doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for others. We're doing it to uplift. We're doing it for society. We're doing it to create a healing space. And I think after kind of reading about a lot of, you know, violent things happening at concerts, you know, over the past 6 years or so, I really wanted to focus on consciously creating a safe space at my concerts, you know, physically safe, but also emotionally safe. You know, some of the best moments I've had as a listener or a viewer at concerts or dance shows or what have you, the artist or the leader has created like this incredible space where I felt free to feel my feelings. I never forget, I saw Bill T. Jones in New York, and it was like life-changing, and I had never seen modern dance before. And those lessons kind of stuck with me because a lot of my audience is new to jazz, new to R&B. Sometimes it's their first concert ever. And that is such a sacred honor to create that space. You know, my first concert ever was Michael Jackson, the Bad Tour, you know? And I'll never forget, there was a moment where he threw his hat out at the end of Smooth Criminal, and every single person in the stadium stood up, including me, and reached for the hat instinctively. And it was such a cool, beautiful, like, lesson in how music can really unite us, you know, regardless of age or race or, you know, what have you, politics. So yeah, I try to just really set the stage, you know, bring the musicians who I know are going to be the most sensitive, and then take the audience on a journey. And I rarely use a set list because I try to feel where people are with me and then go on a journey together.
Do you see yourself as inspired by having MJ as your first concert ever? Has that really informed you as a performer? Because that's such a rare thing. I don't think I've ever talked to anyone who had Michael Jackson as their first concert.
I mean, it was all downhill from there. You know what I mean? It's, you know, but I mean, the thing that's cool about Michael, and I don't think he gets enough credit for it, is he was pretty genreless himself. You know, when you look at Thriller and Bad, there's so much rock in there, there's so much funk, there's so much R&B, there's so much pop, there's all kind of stuff, you know. And he was doing covers, he was doing Come Together, which is the first time I heard that song, you know. And it kind of, I think it planted a lot of seeds in my mind, because, you know, I do a lot of covers myself, and sometimes that's the first time people have heard of Bill Withers or Erykah Badu or Billie Holiday, you know. And what I love about an artist like Michael or Beyonce or Taylor Swift, these high level pop artists, they never underestimate their audience. You know, they give them everything. They give it to you at every level. They give you the entry level to the highest level of artistry. And I really respect that. You know, I think that's what I got from Michael. He's like, if I'm not going to get you with this great band, I'm going to get you with these great vocals. I'm going to get you with this outfit, or I'm going to get you with this, you know, my dance moves. I'm going to get you one way or another, and I'm going to take you somewhere you've never been before. And I like the idea of, you know, this kind of like magic, you know, in our society that still exists, where you can open a book or go to a concert, and at the end of that experience, you're a different person. You've learned something. You've gone through some kind of passageway. And that's what I got from Michael. I was like, oh, I'm a performer now. I saw Michael Jackson. I was like, well, I'm a performer. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I was eight, and I was like, well, that's what I do. And, you know, now you could spend decades of therapy and college education trying to get that idea implanted into somebody's head. But, you know, when I saw Michael, I was like, yeah, that's it.
It's really neat. Collaboration seems to be a recurring theme in your work. How do you go about choosing collaborators, and what do you value most in a creative partnership?
It's a great question. Well, what I value most is honesty. You know, I think that I've done a lot of collaborations over the years, and I think when both sides are acknowledging that we're going to create something that's different, that's something that we can't do alone, and maybe a bit more unusual for each of us, that's when the best things happen. For example, when I collaborated with Hindi Zara, I went to Paris with no band, nothing, just a little song idea, which she hated, by the way. And we literally created that song from nothing, from scratch, with no band. We recorded all the parts. And that was like my first real lesson in true collaboration. Like, we're just two people coming together, having a conversation, seeing what happens. And so I guess what I look for now is something that's going to challenge me, and maybe expand my idea of what creativity is. You know, I think it's really easy. This is my 12th album, and I think it's really easy to sort of start to coast around this moment in a career, like mid-career. And like, yeah, I kind of get it. I know how it works, and da 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 da. And, you know, this is where I, like David Bowie or, you know, sort of like my heroes, I want to keep pushing and staying creative and, yeah, finding something new. You know, that's the thing. It's like, when you collaborate with somebody, they have like this wealth of experience and knowledge. And if you can sort of tap into that and give of yourself to it, it works both ways. Sometimes artists really feel like, I don't know, we get in our heads and we feel like we don't have anything to offer, you know, or we like look at the accolades of another artist and think, oh, they're so much cooler or better, or they've done this, or they've won this Grammy or whatever, you know? So it's really refreshing sometimes to just sit down together at a piano and say, like, how are you feeling today? You know, and like start from there.
So look at your music, and I've noticed it often tackles themes of identity, self-discovery. Can you speak to the role that personal experiences play in shaping your songs?
Great questions. I knew you were going to come with the tough questions. You know, I straddle many worlds, and I feel like I don't fully belong in any of them. You know, my mom is 10th generation Irish American, you know, Irish Catholic. My dad is Afro-Panamanian via Panama, born and raised in Panama. And I'm from the Midwest, you know, as well. from a city that most Americans don't know where it is that I've met. You know, they if I say Prince, then they're, oh, yeah, that's where Prince is from. But they don't know where Minneapolis actually is, you know, in my experience, you know. So it's kind of like a strange, I don't know, identity, because I've also lived in London, Amsterdam. You know, now I live in Pasadena. I lived in New York for most of my adult life. So I've really kind of had a lot of diverse experiences. And depending on my hairstyle or the what I'm wearing, I'm often perceived as many different cultures, Puerto Rican, Panamanian, you know, Moroccan, what have you, you know, until I open my mouth, you know, everyone thinks I'm Brazilian or, you know, I probably would have been a great spy in another life, you know. But I think I've learned a lot, because when, for example, something like, you know, the George Floyd tragedy happened, I sort of can see both sides of the scenario. You know, I largely grew up in a white neighborhood, but being Black, you know, so I think I've been able to, yeah, have empathy for all levels of society, which I think is pretty rare, and I think it's pretty needed. And I don't think there's any answers other than sort of like personal revelations of identity. What I've come to for myself is that identity is sort of what you claim. It's what you feel. And that's been really empowering, you know, on all facets of my life and career.
What's the best song you've wrote that most people might not know about?
Ooh, I would say While You Were Sleeping. That is probably the song I'm proudest of as a songwriter. I think it's, at the time, was definitely my most personal. And yeah, lyrically, harmonically, I love that song. And I also produced it. So like the arc of it, I think it's something crazy, like 9 minutes long or something. And it's all recorded live. So, you know, it's kind of like the best of my talents, I think, as a band leader, as a producer, a songwriter, and performer. But I think it was a little bit too heavy for people at the time. They were expecting like a party follow-up album, and I was not in that space.
What advice would you give to aspiring musicians who are trying to carve out their own unique sound and make a mark in the industry?
So I heard this a lot as a young artist, and it really actually pissed me off. So I'm going to add that caveat. But I think your time will come, you know, and that could be incredibly frustrating at moments. Certainly in this very youth-focused, youth-oriented TikTok moment. But when I look at the history of the music business, I see, you know, Bill Withers getting his first record deal at a very mature age. I see, you know, John Coltrane not being discovered as a solo artist until very late in his career. You know, you just never know, you know, Sharon Jones, you know, the Dap Kings, again, you know, or there's no rhyme or reason to it. And I think that's sort of can be frustrating, but also empowering. I think the longer you work on your sound, your ideas, and your craft, when it gets discovered, you'll have something to say. On the other end of it is, I think sometimes artists get discovered too soon, and then they're not ready for the moment, and all the scrutiny. And when that door opens, you can't close it. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. And it's kind of hard to know that it's a marathon, because everyone will tell you that it's a race. You know, it's a sprint, but it's a marathon. You know, it really is, regardless of genre. You know, when you look at people like Beck or Slash or Joni Mitchell, you know, or Herbie Hancock, people who have been in the industry for so long and they've gone through so many different changes and styles, you start to realize, okay, it doesn't really matter when you get discovered. It just matters that you're ready when you do get discovered and that you can stay in it and stay creative and stay positive. So I think that's the best advice.
So wonderful to speak with Jose James. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Song Facts Podcast. And if you did, tell a friend and share this episode. As always, we're proud to be a member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Check out our brother and sister podcasts on Pantheon, including my other podcast, Stephanie and Stephanie Talk Tunes. Thank you so much for listening to Song Facts Podcast. And for the stories behind the songs, go to songfacts.com. See you next episode. Peace out.
Get your song facts. Get your song facts right here. Song facts right here.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.